Welcome to Living Chronic, the podcast that explores the realities of living with chronic illness and disability while redefining how we thrive in our personal and professional lives. I'm your host, Brandi Shantz, a disabled veteran and chronic illness warrior, here to discuss the challenges, triumphs, and untapped potential of life with a chronic condition. Before we dive in, please take a minute to hit the subscribe button on whatever platform you're listening. Now, let's change the way we think about disability together. I'm Brandi Shantz, and you're listening to Living Chronic. Today, I'm here with Robert Stack. He is the author of Silent No Longer, Advancing the Fight for Disability Rights. He is a 40-year career veteran working in the disability community, a wealth of knowledge. I'm really excited to have him on the show today. So welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate coming on your show.
So why don't you start by telling me a little bit about your 40-year career? I know that's hard to condense into one quick intro when you've done so much great work, but as best you can, tell me a little bit about this wonderful career you've had.
Sure. Quickly, the elevator pitch, if you will. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a priest. Mm-hmm. And so I told my parents that I wanted to join the seminary to be a Franciscan monk. And mm-hmm. I was 12. And they actually figured out I could do that. And they sent me away to the seminary school. And in the seminary, you had to take Latin 6 days a week. You had to take French 6 days a week, math 6 days a week, and English 6 days a week. But you had Wednesday afternoon off and Saturday afternoon off. And you had the ability, you had the opportunity of picking two choices. You could either play sports, which I was terrible, or you could volunteer and help do something. So I decided to volunteer, and I kind of just, serendipitously wound up in a situation where I was working with children with severe disabilities who lived in this large facility. And I worked with a particular little girl who was born without a disability. But what would happen is if you called her, she would run up to you instead of me because she could detect you were a woman rather than a man. And I didn't know anything. I was 13. And it turned out that she'd been born without any disabilities, but her father was psychotic and he tried to smother her with a pillow and he caused significant brain damage. Mm. So she had this affinitude towards gravitate towards a woman rather than a man. And when I met her, she drooled all over herself and she couldn't speak. And she had kind of strange behavior. And I worked with her every Wednesday and every Saturday for 3 full years. And I would take her to the mall and I got her to chew and I got her to start talking a little bit. And I got her to do a lot of things that she would, and I didn't know anything about any disability or any kind of therapy or rehabilitation or anything. Mm-hmm. And it worked out really well. And then I decided that I didn't want to be a priest anymore. And I went to school. And I was in school for a long time and I went to Europe and I went to college. I was going to teach philosophy. Mm. And I was going to get a master's degree in philosophy and then I was going to get a PhD. And one of the seminarians he was graduating and they were going to have this big party and they invited me. So I went back to see them all and I figured, as long as I'm here, I'll go to that school. And the school was closed. Mm. And then I found out that they had taken all the people that lived in that place and they put them in an institution called Pennhurst. Hmm. So I eventually found out that in Pennhurst, that's where she was. And I kind of really wanted to find out what happened to her. And about a year or so later, I went to Pennhurst and she was in a bed tied up with rags, hands and feet and neck. It was 5-point restraints.
Gosh.
And I didn't understand why. And so I went back I was teaching at Kent State and I thought I'm going to get her out of there. And I didn't know how to, cause I wasn't related to her. And she passed away while she was in the facility. And I kind of like put the magic marker down and said, I'm going to go do something. And I took a very big pay cut and I went to work in the state of New York to try to emancipate people with disabilities from large institutions like this girl, Tanya.
Oh, good for you.
So that was the start of my career.
It's so hard to think about someone being treated that way.
this is a person. This is a human being. And, you said it. She just happened to be a victim of her own circumstance. She happened to have been, a victim of her father trying to suffocate her. This could happen to any one of us, and we're all human beings. It's so hard to really imagine treating somebody that way. So thank goodness you were there to, just experience that and understand that people need help when they're going through situations like this.
Yeah. So if we took two bookends and we put them, that being the beginning of my career, and there's a lot of stuff that happened in between. Mm-hmm. And then the very end that caused me to write this book. There's a fellow, and in the book I had to give him a different name. I gave him the name Aaron. And what happened to Aaron was he lived in a place called the Rotlandsburg Center. And the Rotlandsburg Center still exists, and it's in Massachusetts. And they use aversive conditioning, capital punishment, if you will, as a way of treating people with disabilities still to this day.
Oh, my goodness.
So the state of New Hampshire at the time was under a court order to get him out of that institution. And when we went up to look at him, he, again, it was like a flashback. He was tied up on a conference table. And so we said, well, we can take care of him, but we didn't have any housing or anything for him to live in that would be suitable for him in New Hampshire. But we did have some homes available in San Antonio, Texas. So when we flew him to San Antonio, they decided that they wanted to put him on an air vac to bring him because, again, he had no value, honestly, Brandy. So he had no way to getting commercial air because he didn't have a driver's license. He didn't have an ID of any sort at all. So he couldn't go anyway. But besides that, he had a lot of aberrant behavior. In any event, we flew him down to San Antonio. And when they opened up the doors of the plane, that was a private plane in a private airfield, they threw him out onto the tarmac like a sack of potatoes. He was in leg irons and handcuffs. Mm-hmm. So the woman who works in San Antonio, her name is Samantha Cutler, and she's a terrific director there. She grabbed my arm and she's saying to them, take these handcuffs off. And they said, no can do because he might get violent in the car. So she demanded they take his leg irons off. And we transported him to the house, a typical, middle home in San Antonio. And when he walked in, they were manhandling. And she said, remove the handcuffs and leave. This is our house. Leave. Mm-hmm. So she made them leave. And that was about a year ago. And now they take him to rodeos.
Oh.
He shops and he's doing really, really well. He engages with people and he's on the cover of my book. And that's the fellow so it's kind of like because people say to me, oh, when did this happen? In 1960? And it happened in a year ago. So it's just outrageous to me that this still goes on, and that's the bookends.
So right.
Do you want to hear the middle?
I told you already. I could probably spend hours speaking with you. There's so much to learn. What an impressive career and so much that we all need to learn as well about what it means to be disabled. I talk a lot about what it means to become suddenly disabled as a person who, very suddenly became a chronically ill disabled person with a lot of issues. But there are so many people who live with this their entire lives or who may suddenly become intellectually disabled much later in life. And there's just not much focus on how do we really treat these human beings and how do we assign worth to these human beings in our society. And I learned, really, we don't assign much worth to them. And I thought I knew a lot about living as a disabled person in this country. One of my best friends has two very disabled children. They both have Down syndrome. One is also autistic and nonverbal. So I thought, I think I know a lot. But I realized I don't know that much at all. And it really depends on where you live and who you're born to as to how you're going to be treated. I know you talked about funding and your future based on your zip code. Of course, I live in the DC metro area along with my friend who has the two very disabled children. And of course, everybody here, you know, we all, pretty much all of us have graduate degrees, careers, a pretty good living career money-wise. But not all children like hers have the same outcomes.
Sure.
And you talk about that disparity based on where you live and where you're from.
Sure. The truth of the matter is that my nonprofit Community Options does is we take people either from their mom and dad, they might have had a child and now they're older. Dad might have a chronic heart disease, and mom might not be able to take care of the child, the sibling, the son or daughter, and we'll come and we'll develop a small house for that person plus two other people or one other person to live in. And so we provide the supports that they need. But what I've noticed is that it depends on what state you're in relative to the kind of funding. Medicaid Medicaid is not an equal playing field.
Right.
Medicaid is really based on how each state decides they want to access Medicaid and whether or not they want to try to get as much out of it as they can because they can match it or mm-hmm. whether they don't want to. So in states like New Hampshire or Maryland, which is where you're hailing from, the Medicaid rates that we can pay for direct care and for the services that people need are significantly higher than they are in states like Texas or certainly Mississippi, or even Utah, or Florida. So because they choose not to provide the kind of robust services that they can in other states. So it is a matter of where your zip code is. That's important. And it's a matter of learning what you need to do in order to access the services.
Which can be difficult. And I didn't realize just how difficult it can be and how little we talk about it. I'm actually just on the other side of DC. I'm in Virginia. And when I was offered the position on the State Rehabilitation Council, now I'm the chairperson of that council, I did not realize just how few people even know we exist. They don't know how to access any of the services we offer. They don't understand the politics and policies surrounding it and how much of our funding does come from the federal government and how much your state is willing to put into it does reflect what that output is going to be in funding. So I've learned a lot around that in my time on the council. And, you know, just again, thinking about having the difference of having a very well-educated parent in a wealthier household. You know, my friends with two very disabled children are both attorneys. And both of them have said, even as attorneys, we're confused by all the paperwork it requires to get the children the help that they absolutely need. So when you think about that, you know, that I'm you know, knee deep in policy and figuring out how to get funding when I live in a state that's willing and ready to put forward as much as we can to help others that need it the most. When I live in a place where people have Juris Doctor degrees and master's degrees and PhDs, and we're still saying, hey, what the heck is this? This is hard. What are people doing when they live in a place like Florida, Louisiana? You know, maybe they don't have much in the way of education, much less a Juris Doctorate to get through the mountains of paperwork and legal mumbo jumbo it takes to get the care that their children absolutely 10,000% need.
Yeah, it's it seems like they have to self-educate almost. And the problem is that when you start early on, the school systems will tell you what you're allowed and what you're not allowed to do. And what parents don't know is some of the actual statutes. There's the IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. as an example. And that says that everyone has a right to a free and appropriate education, and that that has to be provided for them, regardless of the cost, regardless of where they are. And so families don't really know this, or they'll be told, oh, we can't afford this, or they can't. And by reality, by law, they should be able to provide those services. So that's an important kind of change that needs to be brought to bear. The other thing is, parents don't realize, and I don't know really, you know, how they figure this out, but there's a waiting list of literally 300,000 to 600,000 people who are waiting for services, for housing, et cetera, as adults with disabilities. And parents need to know to put their names on that queue as early as they possibly can. So, mm-hmm. So that's an important thing that they have to do. And again, if you look at, where you live, your zip code, Virginia, the rate per day to provide services to an adult child with disabilities is about 400 a day. In Texas, it's 150.
Wow.
And that's 300. That's 24 hours. That's not, you know.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, you know, staff and insurance, food, housing, transportation, something to do during the day. You see what I mean? It becomes
right.
Almost an impossible task. So, and even in Virginia, 400 is high, but it's not that high compared to like Maryland or other states.
Right. Of course, you know, people who don't live in the DC area or in Virginia won't get this, but, you know, we always like to say there's two Virginias. There's Northern Virginia and the DC metro area and the rest of Virginia. And we deal with a bit of that in Richmond as well. But looking at the funding that goes into this, my career started in the Department of Defense. And as a very young Army officer, we were, you know, thrown into 9/11 after, you know, that post 9/11 period, global war on terrorism. I mean, there was a period of time where funding was seemingly unlimited. We would just kind of wake up in the morning and sneeze $1 million and nobody thought twice about it. So, and even when we went through all of these various measures to cut back on spending over the years and whatnot, still we had so much funding compared to what we see in the disability community. And it always amazes me what, you know, so many people are doing on such a tight budget to try to help the people who need it most. I never thought in a million years that I would be trying to figure out how to do so much on such a small budget when I came from a world where, you know, $700 million contracts, not really that big of a deal. And we're trying to run entire nationwide programs on a very teeny tiny small fraction of a budget like that. Just knowing how difficult that is in every aspect of it, one of them, of course, being caregivers. Even those of us who just have, you know, it's hard to rate various disabilities. My husband takes care of me when I need it, but you know, I'm obviously very self-sufficient in many ways, but I'm always thankful for him being able to take time off work to be able to take care of me as necessary. But there are people who need a lot more care than me, and we're just not doing the stuff we need to be doing to help caregivers and giving them the kind of wages they need. And of course, I know, you talk a lot about that. I'm especially interested to hear your thoughts on it in respect to all of the news around the cuts to Medicaid. I know the Senate just passed the bill today, but you know, we're recording July 1st. So the Senate just passed their version of the budget bill maybe an hour ago. We'll see what the House does with it. But let me know, you know, what do you think, you know, in terms of first, you know, just the issues we have in respect to caregivers, caregiver wages, caregiver support, and then in addition, you know, potential cuts in the future, what we're looking at.
Well, yeah, that's great. First of all, I thank you for your service, and I don't know, and I appreciate that. And I think that, you know, the problem that we don't realize, you know, people don't they take direct care service workers for granted. Mm-hmm. And truth of the matter is, you know, if you go back to Texas again, you're lucky if you can afford, based on the rates, $13 to $14 an hour, which is about what they pay. They pay more than that in Chick-fil-A. Mm-hmm. So when you take that into account, and then the highest wages I've seen that we pay is about $20 an hour in New Hampshire. So it kind of varies a large gamut, but $20 an hour translates into about $40,000 a year. But these are people that have to take care of a person all 8 hours a day, you know, all the time. And that's where the Medicaid dollars go. And I think what you said before about defense spending and that sort of thing was interesting. Because, you know, we all know that like much of the defense spending that's there is very much needed. And then sometimes, you know, they always talk about the cliche of the golden toilet seat or whatever that might be the issue. In Medicaid, the thing I find fascinating is they're talking about cutting Medicaid or how are we going to deal with Medicaid, when really they just need to look at where they're spending Medicaid dollars on. Right now, I just got this statistic recently. $80 billion per year is spent on people with disabilities in institutions and nursing homes for people under the age of 40. And right now, Brandy, there are over 4,000 children living in nursing homes, so, which is, you know, 4,000 people too many. So I think that what really has to happen with Medicaid is they've got to rebalance it. They've got to look at how to effectively. So if I give you a great example, back to Texas. If you live in an institution in El Paso, the cost per person is about $580,000 a year. But if you grow over that little wall in El Paso to where our community programs are, it's about $60,000 a year.
Wow.
So the question is, obviously we can support a lot more people for what it would cost that way. So there's got to be somebody in Texas has to wake up and say, this is something's wrong with this paradigm. This paradigm, there has to be some changes in what our priorities are with budgets. But what happens is they look at these institutions as ways of keeping everyone employed in that local community. And then, and if you deinstitutionalize the person, you can also deinstitutionalize the staff and retrain them on what's going to happen. They can get a different job and they can learn different skills.
Yes.
And benefit from that as well.
Yeah. Well, you're singing my song because that's so often the budgetary issues. You know, everybody loves to talk politics. Nobody loves to talk policy. I always say DC is not an entertainment news cycle. We are boring, boring, boring. But certainly, you know, the reality of the situation is so many very expensive programs are kept in place because of the people they employ. And that's the same in DOD. And, you know, especially since I've become a disabled person myself, my song is let's retrain people instead of throwing them out. It's not as we're not facing a situation where it's either they do exactly what they've always done or, oh, well. We can convert skills. We can retrain. We can take a look at how we're employing people, make it different. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, I think, so much of the point in so many budgetary issues that we face here in DC is you're looking at where is this money going? How are we moving these monies? Are they fungible? Well, yes, they can be fungible, and we can do that through training people.
And you brought up a very valid and very important point, which is employment in general. I think that people with disabilities are totally an underutilized market. They come to work, they bring dignity and grace. They're happy to be at the job. They're going to be on time. They're not going to bring drama with them to the
workers.
And they're happy to work and willing to work and they're a great asset to jobs. And you being in the rehab community and professionally, you understand this more than anybody. And I think that some of the old school methods of using workshops where they have a bunch of people sanding wood or putting, you know, paper clips in boxes, that paying them sub minimum wage, paying them a dollar a day, those days are past. And with certainly with the implementation of artificial intelligence or business intelligence,
yes,
certainly robotics, certainly a lot of the other things that are going on, there can be a place for people with disabilities where their skill set can be augmented and they can be used for other kinds of variety of resources where they're going to improve. Not only that, but they'll be a consistent worker for the employer to be at. And I think that that's another issue that needs to really be addressed. And employers got to be educated even better about how people with disabilities can, in fact, have jobs.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I do love that I'm seeing a lot, particularly here in the Northern Virginia region, has a heavy focus on federal consulting. We're seeing people, young disabled people, be trained to do very special and specific types of analysis for places like Department of Navy or Department of Army. And, you know, there's some small and mid-sized companies here paying to get these people trained up, paying to get their top secret clearance so they can work in these facilities. And you know what? It's a great program that's really working. It just really proves that when you employ disabled people, they do the job, they do it very well. They do it in a way that many people don't have that. They just don't have that same capability. There's a uniqueness to, you know, every disability comes with its counterpart strength, they say, where you get something that, you know, counterparts it in some way. And we do need to be talking to companies more about hire disabled, really get their buy-in on this.
Absolutely. It's a fundamental need. And as again, they can bring dignity and grace, and they can come to their job and they're looking at getting it done. And they can fill a need that maybe they weren't looking at as a possibility before.
Absolutely. And they want to be there. And as somebody who has, you know, managed large teams and hired and all the things that so many of the rest of us do, isn't that what you really want?
Absolutely.
Employees really want to be there. So I did want to touch on something that you talk about, and I think everybody can relate to this these days. It's not just the developmentally or intellectually disabled community. It's not just the chronically ill community. This is just, it's more and more. It's every human body in the United States of America is experiencing some pain point from this. And you talk about the rise of private equity firms investing in facilities that prioritize profits over care. And of course, that's a big subject now, again, because it's starting to touch everybody, every human body in the United States. So tell me a little bit about this and what you see.
Well, I started this nonprofit a long time ago, and I started it to help people with disabilities. I did not start it because I wanted to make a money. That was not the mm-hmm. object of the game. And now we're expanded. We're in 12 states. We have 7,000 employees. And one day, it's quite frankly, Brandy had a knock at my door, and it was somebody from private equity sliding me over a proposal where I'm supposed to be quiet, not talk. And right. And I said, this is New Jersey. We don't like to have envelopes. And they laughed. And I said, what is it? And they basically were offering me a ridiculous amount of money to take over Community Options. They would change the board. And they would make us a subsidiary of their for-profit and then do that. And of course, I said no. And I kind of felt like, you know, I felt like I was in a wonderful life. And I was Jimmy Stewart shaking Mr. Potter's hand saying, you know, I don't want this. And quite frankly, they were upset about it. But the truth of the matter is we don't compromise I wouldn't compromise my integrity in order to fulfill money as the end of the game. And what they're doing is, and I understand private equity. I mean, private equity has a wonderful, you know, role if they're consolidating computer companies or there's a, mm-hmm. there's a public company that becomes delisted and they need to pick up that company or they want to buy that company and figure out how to fix it. But what they're starting to do is they'll take nonprofits, they'll bundle them together, they'll squeeze as much money as they possibly can. They will try as hard as they can to kind of skirt the regulatory authorities in order to hit not the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law or the spirit of the regulation until they can just get it down to something else. And they'll either sell it or break it off into parts or whatever. I mean, right now, Brandy, I have 650 homes that Community Options owns, which is a lot of real estate. And we have, you know, a couple of million square feet of office buildings throughout the 60 offices throughout the country. Mm-hmm. So they would love this equity.
Absolutely.
And they would sell it or whatever. So one of the things I've done is I put in place a way that even when I pass, that that can't happen, that there's a fail safe that will prevent me from community options becoming anything other than remaining as community options, because that's not why we did it. But I watched them do it in New Hampshire, and their quality went down so bad, they kicked the state of New Hampshire kicked them out of the state and mm-hmm. asked us to take over. I've watched them in other states where, again, they look at, they'll depreciate, they'll use tax methodological approaches to make money, all on the backs of people with disabilities.
Right.
And you're a veteran. I got news. They're trying to do it in prison systems.
Yep.
And they're going to be doing it with veterans if they haven't already. It's yes. just a matter of time. Once they see that there's a dollar figure attached to something, then they're going to figure out, if I can make a dollar on this, I'm going to do it.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting, you know, this is a subject that I'm talking about a lot as a veteran. I'm doing an entire special series coming up talking about that, because most of my health care is at the Veterans Affairs Hospital. I get great care there because I have very specific veteran illnesses, you know, very unique, very severe. Other veterans are experiencing these, and having those specialized doctors who see this day in, day out, because all they do is look at veterans, is very important. So, you know, this notion that I'm supposed to get better care if they just put me out to this community, it's a farce. And we're all experiencing it, and nobody's immune. Nobody's immune. And, you know, I'm an MBA. I love business. I love, you know, increased shareholder wealth was beaten into us daily in business school. You know, that's what you learn. But at some point we, as a society, need to decide when we're going to take a look at total health and total equality of respect for all persons, whether they be a shareholder or not. You know, what are we doing to the quality of our care for especially the most vulnerable, who are just as equal as citizens and as human beings as the next person?
Commoditizing the vulnerable is absolutely despicable.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So you say that we have 12 action steps that we need to do. So what's our takeaway? What are our marching orders?
Well, I think that there's a variety of ways that you can go about them, but without getting into the weeds about them, I just think that the action steps are, you know, we have to advocate at the state level. That's one of the most fundamental. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly what we see here. But and again, if you're in Mississippi, I'll give you a great example. In New York, there's over 500 nonprofits that do what I do. In Mississippi, there's 3.
Oh my goodness!
Because it's not safe, and so that's one of the most important things. We have to advocate in the at the state level. Others are we really need to figure out how to get the political will, mm-hmm. and the political will is the most important. You know, I went to Mississippi as an example with my wife, and she had a little difficulty trying to understand the governor because of his accent, but he decided he wanted to do it, and it was the rates in Mississippi were like $50 a day to provide total care to people.
Oh my goodness!
Do it, but the legislature got involved, and they said we don't want the federales regulating what we do, so they turned down the fact that they could bring in a lot of Medicaid dollars to augment their services, and so they have the highest number. I believe it's about 30% of their people are living in institutions with disabilities, and the state of Mississippi is not doing what they're supposed to do. Another is that we have to change language. I give example. We're so used to talking about the special people taking the special bus to special ed because they're special. I say to everyone, special should only mean things on sale or occasions. And right. People don't want to be special. We want to be invisible. We want to be part of everybody else. We don't want you to drive down the street, Brandy, and say, that's where they live, or those right. are special people. Because that connotes pity. It connotes a whole variety of empathy that's not really empathy. It's more of a pity. And so we're trying to get rid of that. We think that and then fundamentally, we have to get people with disabilities jobs. We all should work on getting people with disabilities jobs. We have a program called VINE, which stands for Volunteers in Need of Employment. What we do with VINE is we say, hey, why don't you just interview someone with a disability? We know you don't have any jobs available, but what we found is that after some soft marketing, they'll say, you know, I have a friend, Mary, and she has a beauty parlor and she's looking for someone to sweep up. I think that's a good thing for them to do. And maybe I'll contact her and I'll see if I can set up an interview for the person that you're, for this person I'm interviewing. So volunteers in need of employment is something that we also do. So those are some important steps that we push.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning state advocacy. I cannot emphasize enough. I think so many people think that there's just this big federal government helping all the disabled people in the world and doing all the good work, when it's really there's so much up to your state to do the right things to get some of that federal funding. And it requires you going to your state and saying, hey, we need this funding.
Exactly. And I've had families do that. And, Lincoln said you can fool some of the people some of the time. You can't fool all the people all the time. But I paraphrase that and say, but you can never, ever fool a mother.
That's true.
I think that when they realize, like we had moms in saying, coming to the government, to the legislature and saying, we need these services for our children. You have to figure out how we can galvanize a group of people in order to make this happen. And that's an important factor as well.
No, that's a great note to end on. I do want to mention your new book, Silent No Longer, Advancing the Fight for Disability Rights, is available now. You can order it off Amazon. Is there anywhere else that everybody can buy your book?
Barnes Noble.
Barnes & Noble, my favorite gathering spot still. That's perfect. So be sure to buy the book. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Robert. I really appreciate it. This has been amazing.
Thank you very, very much. I greatly appreciate it.
That's a wrap for this episode of Living Chronic. I hope today's conversation gave you insight, inspiration, or at least a little reassurance that you're not alone on this journey. Living with a chronic illness or disability comes with its challenges, but it also comes with strength, resilience, and a community that understands. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who might need to hear it. You could follow me on Instagram at @chronicallybrandyshantz, other socials at @brandyshantz, or my website at brandyshantz.com for more discussions, advocacy updates, and everyday strategies for thriving with a chronic illness. And if you have a topic you'd like to hear about, send me a message. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, keep pushing forward, keep advocating for yourself, and remember, you are more than your diagnosis. You are powerful. You are unstoppable. Thanks for listening to Living Chronic. See you next time.